just an answer machine. I don't know what's going on with that. Maybe we should just go into it, I guess. Whatever.
Though I'm going to suggest maybe clipping all this other crap. Like us.
Oh, this is the around. Spice of Always Record. This is what makes us who we are.
No. No.
We're always wrestling with Skype. And we always
it's
find
good
a
to
way.
Minimize. Minimize it at least a little bit to the best of our ability.
Hello,
because we got some dedicated fan base that, you know, they're just wrestling around when this is going on for us. Because they just want us to get down to the meat of the biscuit. And
the
it's
meat
just,
of the biscuit.
It drives them crazy.
We're going to change the title of the show. Meat of the
to
biscuit.
To meat of the biscuit.
That's cool. I'm down with that. Get down to brass tacks. So why don't you go into your deal first?
Oh, I don't know if it's really... I wasn't even necessarily going to bring it up, but sure, it was just to say that this morning I had a dental appointment, and I'm sitting in this waiting room, and they put on Disney's Brother Bear, which was a weird choice because there was like a kid in the waiting room, but the rest were all like much older people.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, it's like... I'm in this room with, like, a bunch of 60-somethings, a few middle-aged people, and, like, this one little kid that wasn't even watching the movie. But they put, whatever, so they put this thing on, and what was weird, I mean, whatever, like, you know, I'm not a big, like, oh my god, Masonic imagery or whatever, but it was pretty, like, smack you in the face, blatant, Masonic imagery, like as soon as the movie started, and that they're talking about this, they show this mountain with like the Aurora Borealis like hovering over it, and they're talking about how this is where the spirits of the ancestors talk to them through this great light at the top of the mountain. What they're showing is basically a mountain peak or pyramid with a light shining on it. These like sparkling lights above it, and saying how that's their spirit guides and all this sort of stuff. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. It very clearly. And then the title Brother Bear comes up over it, and I realized that the A in bear is designed as an eye in a pyramid. If you can look up the logo for Brother Bear, it's pretty. I didn't notice it when I had first seen it. It just looks like a double line. I don't know. It looks like almost like, you know, you have your compass points of the letter A and then a line going across. But this is looks like a double line across. Trying to emulate some sort of Inuit character or something. You know, it's still very possible that it was just a, you know, a stylized choice, or that's at least how it's being masked. But it's once you see it superimposed over a mountain peak, a triangular mountain peak with this white shining down on it, it's like, oh, okay, that's a fucking eye in a pyramid. Which is all good and fine, except for the fact that Tina Turner starts singing.
Yeah.
And, very interesting change from her role in Mad Max and what I would normally associate Tina Turner with, to her singing this song while they're looking at the fucking eye in the pyramid and this mountain light, and she's singing to the spirits to lead us. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of fucking creepy. And then I got called in to my thing, and so that's... is basically it. It's about these three brothers, and they each have like a totem animal spirit. And what I thought was interesting is this one guy gets his totem spirit is the bear, but then he ends up encountering a bear, and he almost gets, you know, he's getting attacked by it. So his brothers try and save him, and his brother who wears the eagle around his neck ends up sacrificing himself to save them from the bear, and like the bear like swats him down, and he ends up having to like sacrifice himself to the bear to save his other brothers. So here you have this bear and eagle battling it out. Couldn't help but make me think of Russia and America. So I don't know. I mean, that's all I saw, and you know, just an open invitation. If someone wants to, I don't think I'm going to go seek out the movie to keep digging further. But
I was thinking, Ursa Major, the large bear constellation, is coming to mind, and I was considering that, like. I saw in a Manly P. Hall book, The Secret Destiny of America, where he's talking about the different constellations that rule the different continents and how that's the explanation of, like, America is the eagle, but America is the phoenix. So we're ruled by Scorpio, whereas the bear was Russia, but that's not a sign, that's a constellation. But I thought that that was, I don't know, I'm just, I mean, why did Russia come up yesterday? Oh, first of all, Andreas, who we're going to have on the show and hopefully still will, he sent me a video of the space station that they're building in Russia, in Kazakhstan, but it's Russians, it's a Russian space station. It's like pretty much the biggest space station that's ever been attempted. They're supposedly wanting to have manned missions to the moon for long-term stays on the moon by 2016. I don't know. And then also, you know, Kubrick has been coming up a lot with Dr. Strangelove, but I don't know. That's what that made me think of. And I don't know about the Masonic scene in Russia, but...
Well, you know, in Kazakhstan, there is a giant, what they call the Pyramid of Peace. Kazakhstan is covered with really weird imagery that a lot of conspiracy theorists sort of drool over, because they have their main city center has these two giant pillars, and then they have in it, in the center of that, they have this giant glass pyramid, what they call the Pyramid of Peace, and at the top of this thing is this weird handprint. I think we discussed this on an episode, early episode. I brought this up. There is, do you remember at the end of Total Recall, he's got to stick his hand in the handprint to turn on the machine?
Yeah, totally.
Well, in Kazakhstan, there is, in this pyramid, there is that at the top of it. This just domed handprint. It's weird.
Cool. You had mentioned that there's three brothers in the film.
Uh-huh.
So I'm looking at here. I don't know. How do you say this? Alterism? Another alterism? It's A-S-T-E-R-I-S-M. But anyways, known as the Three Leaps of Gazelle, is recognized in Arab culture, a series of three pairs of stars. And so that make up Ursa Major. So you have like... I don't know. These are Greek letters, but they're different aspects of the first part of it to designate our Greek, but to recognize the different parts of Ursa Major. But you have the first leap, the second leap, and the third leap, and they're leaps of the gazelle. So this is like, I don't know, it's a trippy thing in Arab culture in relationship to this particular constellation. But I find it interesting that the gazelle immediately makes me think of the Shekinah, because that's the animal equated with her, and even for Arab culture, that's not that far removed from that. But
well, they did say the attributes of the three brothers when they were talking about their totem animals, and one brother was guidance, one brother was wisdom, and one brother was love. Which, of course, makes me think—you know—like all this stuff makes me think of like the three pillars of masonry. You know, beauty, justice, and wisdom, things like that.
Yeah, and the lion's paw in 30, the whatever. You're not supposed to talk about that or whatever, but...
Why? The lion's grip?
Yeah.
In the 30 grip? Yeah.
I've had an issue before where I've met masons and like one was looking at my art at this event and like, whatever, he tells me he's a Mason. And so I shake his hand and he's just like, what the fuck? And I'm like, whatever. I was friends with a Mason. You know, he showed me this, you know, and like, he was like, you're not supposed to do that. I'm like, okay, whatever. So
yeah,
you
know, lick my balls. Who cares?
I'm like, you told me you're a Mason in front of a bunch of people, you know, like, whatever. I'm like, there's people sitting around. And I'm like, and I was also like, you know, you didn't have to say anything. You know, you could have just let me do it. You didn't, because all these people are watching us and no one would have known, you know. Anyways.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny because you mentioned the whole lion's grip. So the idea of the lion's grip is a third degree right, and the whole idea there is that because this is where my mind went only because of something I was writing about last night. In the third degree right, what you're reenacting is the death of Hiram Abiff, the death and resurrection of Hiram Abiff, and Hiram is killed by the three ruffians.
Right.
So you have and when I was thinking of these three, I was writing last night about the three ruffians, and it got me thinking, and I'm seeing these three brothers of the same thing, just because that's where my mind was at yesterday. So the story is that basically Hiram is killed by the three ruffians, and then he is resurrected by the lion's grip. So that handshake is to bring Hiram back. And this is this... this is, of course, goes back to Osiris. A lot of authors trace this back to Osiris because Osiris is resurrected in the sign of Leo. So it's the idea that the lion is bringing this deceased, you know, whether it's god or father or paternal figure in the system, is being brought back by the lion.
Hmm. Huh. Yeah, so I like when Kevin Halcott, I believe it was Kevin, that pointed out maybe it wasn't, I don't know, you tell me, that in The Wizard of Oz, where you have the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Lion, you could take that as the fact that the three fingers in the lion's grip are meant to represent all my strength, all my heart, and all my mind, which is, I believe, from the Tanakh, but it's the idea that it's your entire being is given to the craft, right? And so that being like all my heart, Tin Man needs a heart, all my mind, Scarecrow needs a brain, and all my strength, the lion wants his courage, right? And so...
And as I said, the three brothers' attributes were wisdom, or in this case, mind, love, or in this case, heart, and guidance, that he was the leader, or in this case, strength.
Yeah, totally. And then obviously strength is Oz, which is important.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Eternally reiterate. So, and then the two pillars are, like I said, established in strength, established in Oz. And so this also reminds me of in the... I want to say Lars von Sant. Is that my thing?
Lars von Trier?
I'm mixing up two directors there. Yeah, Lars von Trier's Antichrist, he has the three beggars. He says when the three beggars show up, someone's going to die. And the three beggars are literally a constellation with three different aspects. One is a deer, one is a crow, and the other is a fox. Which I thought was interesting. But on a side note...
Wait, so Michael J. Fox, Russell Crowe, and John Deere? No, I'm just fucking around.
I don't know who the deer is. Yeah, I don't know. I was confused, but initially I wasn't confused, and then I got confused with Kenneth Anger. So Kenneth Anger, Kenneth Grant. So I had a friend who was really into Kenneth Grant, and he was the head of he was more Crowley's successor, you know, arguably than most people, except maybe Jack Parsons, right? Like, Kenneth Grant took on Crowley's work, and continued on with really emphasizing the LOM deal. Yeah. So he's head of the OTO. I'm not I'm not in the OTO. I'm not part of the AA, but I looked into it a bit, not as deeply as I could have. My interest in Thelema was mainly just involved reading a ton of Aleister Crowley and not really branching on too much from there, though I did look at some Israel Regarde. Anyway, he was mentioning Iowas as breaking up the word. And so, well, okay. Part of this is my own extrapolation, and it's due to looking at a bit of Kenneth Grant stuff. So I was getting Kenneth Grant confused with Kenneth Anger, or vice versa, just because I had never really watched Kenneth Anger films before, and I started watching them. I'm like, wow, he seems like, so I was like, was that the Kenneth? But anyways, Iowas, literally, like, you could look at it as Ion, with the W being Vav and Oz. So just like Joachim and Boaz are the two pillars of masonry, literally means established in strength. Meanwhile, you know, Boaz is not like, it's not a standard word. I mean, you could make bait into with, and so they say with strength, and I believe that's intentional. I mean, but that's directly from the Torah, so it's written there. It's not like just a Masonic thing in regards to Solomon's temple. But I was considering that if you look at it like Ion, Vav, Oz, you could literally take that as an I for Ion. Ion's an I, like singular I, and it's the devil in tarot, right? Mm-hmm. And Vav is the hierophant, but it's literally a nail, and Vav is designated as a connecting letter. It is literally like if you're building something, say you have two pieces of wood and you connect them together, that's the nail that connects them. Right. And so I was like, huh, it's literally a singular I connected to strength is Iowas, the alien that the extraterrestrial that Crowley contacted through the pyramid, though he's just in Cairo. But still, it was his visit to the pyramid that instigated the Book of the Law. So anyways, I thought that was kind of trippy. I never really thought about, because I never thought about Boaz as with strength. And so I, by extension,
have you considered that since I take Oz is strength and the strength card of the Tarot, we've gone this route, like the idea of the Kundalini is emphasized in there.
Yeah.
So if it's the I connected to the strength, is this like the nail or the connector is sort of like the spine, and you have this I being perhaps the third eye? And it's like when you connect your eye to the Kundalini, you see Iowas?
Yeah. I can dig it completely. I mean, that's just like, it just follows. I mean, that's the extension. And then you have like, I don't know, I've in my collages, I've been tripping. I've been using MGM a lot just because I love like MM Master Mason, you know, like it's just so common.
Around the Masonic G, of course.
Like G, and then it's the lion, you know, and it's literally in Latin, it says art for art's sake above the MGM lion, and just connecting that with the opening of the Wizard of Oz, obviously, but then the fact that MGM put out Poltergeist, and the lion's roar of the MGM lion is the roar of the beast in Poltergeist. They used the sample, so they sampled the fucking sound, and it plays for the crazy white creature, like when he's blocking the door for her to get in.
Hey, isn't on the Thoth temperance, the Thoth version of temperance, which is art?
Yes.
Isn't there a white lion?
I believe there's maybe a white eagle and a red lion, or maybe I'm confused. But that's the way I recall it. I mean,
I'm picturing it the other way, but yeah, maybe you're right. Because when you just, I was going to say that, and you just said white creature.
Say that. Do I have? Oh, it's in the house. With my platypad. If you have the Book of Thoth handy,
it's a red eagle and a white lion. I just pulled it up on Google.
It's awesome. Wow. Okay.
So art for art's sake.
Yeah, but what to say in I guess it's Latin on that across the top, and it's a stone, it's buried stone. It's talking about the philosopher's stone over them, but it's really interesting what it says. and you need the book of to look up art in the Book of Thoth in order to know what it says there. I can't remember off the top of my head. I mean, I could run in the house and grab it, but yeah, no, it never occurred to me a correspondence with that card. That's interesting.
I've also considered that the name Iowas is like a variation on, okay, so Yahweh, when he's asked what is your name, he says I am. So you have the idea of one God being I am, and Iowas being a play on like I was.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So there's like the present tense I am, past tense I was. I was playing with this one day, and then I decided I was going to write a story, and there was going to be like a character, I don't know, fucking like some like Nigerian guy or something named like I will be, something like that.
Ehye, which is a play on Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. It's a variation, and it's part of a, obviously, like most things in there, it's part of a much larger mathematical code.
Is there, would you know the way to say in Hebrew to say, like, essentially, I will be, like a future tense?
No, I could look it up. I mean, no, I know that is literally I am that I am, which is trippy because it's like, you know, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is like the two hays are like reflections of each other. So it's, you know, yeah, anyways. Yeah, I should have my rabbi on the show sometime. I don't know if he'd be into it, but that'd be awesome.
Tell him he can swear.
He, okay, yeah, he, that might appeal to him. Anyways, he'd go on for, you know, 20 minutes on Ehye, and I couldn't do it justice. I keep forgetting, actually, I want to bring some of the translations from Ramak on the show sometime, because I should go through and find some of the really meaty key stuff that we've come across, because it's really appropriate. But anyways, I'm looking at, so I wanted to get a Kenneth Grant book, and other than like the Magic Revival or whatever it is, like the more standard stuff, but like his obscure stuff, he's got one called The Ninth Arch that I'm like, oh, I want to get that book. And it's like $700, you know, anywhere from $500 to $700 or more. And like, I'm just like, damn. And I'm looking for a PDF. I found one where they scanned the pages, but just looking at any part of that makes me think of the Beatles. Like, I get all these Beatle references throughout it. Like, just a really blatant one is that he looks at Lom and relates him to the to an egg, like a space capsule egg. And it's basically, for one thing, it's reminding me of the Star Child in 2001. But then it's, I don't know, it's fucking trippy.
So I found a high-res version of the art card. It's Vitriol, you know, written out behind her on the art card. You know, visit the interior parts of the earth by rectification. Thou shalt find the hidden stone. This is, of course, Alice Underground visiting the interior parts of the earth.
Totally. Yeah, I had these.
Or as I'm sorry, I just want to say, or as I've pointed out, Dorothy going to Oz, the land down under, I see as being very much the same thing. So if it's the land down under, Dorothy's also visiting the interior parts of the earth.
Ooh, I never even thought of the fact that fucking... Okay, so Nicole Kidman is out in Eyes Wide Shut. Where is she from?
Yeah, Australia, exactly.
Ah.
Oz.
So... brings me to the thing that made me gasp last night. We're watching Grey's Anatomy with Matthew Modine. Have you ever seen it?
No.
Movie about med school, and it's from the 80s, and it's a really good movie. I mean, I'd recommend it, you know, beyond Synchronicity. Just it's a good movie. But he's the Joker. He's literally the class clown in med school. And he's literally like, there's one point where he's in a hospital and he's working and they call him. They're like, hey, you jokers. And talking to him and this one other guy who's his fellow student. And the way that it's phrased was like, raised a little eyebrow for me, because we all know Matthew Modine, MM, another Master Mason, is first of all, he's in Batman. And he keeps referring to Robin as a hothead, which fool in Latin, where we get the word fool, literally means it's where we get the term hothead. So, and then I relate the fool with the Joker, you know, but anyways, that's interesting that you're equating Robin with the Joker in that way. But he's Private Joker in Full Metal Jacket, right? And so his roommate in the film, I'm trying to remember his name, but his roommate is Nick Nightingale. So the actor who plays Nick Nightingale in Eyes Wide Shut, who gives him the Fidelio note,
wow,
the witches, the body to the party, who's literally the one who has his eyes wide shut because he's got the fucking
the blindfold. He's been hoodwinked,
but the blindfold wasn't on so well.
Uh huh.
So that's why he tells him. So he's in there, but then this is where it gets a little, you know, whatever, my own little thing here, but I couldn't help but notice. I was watching, so I watch like maybe 10 movies or something with different albums, and there's a couple that I would recommend to people that they check out, but I did a lot of experimentation this last week, but one of them was just watching, this one I wouldn't recommend as much necessarily, but I watched The Cell with J-Lo. It'd be fun to watch it with one of her albums, but I actually watched it with Tool's Undertow, which is cool. I mean, I would like to work on the timing more, and I don't know if it would ever land like I'd want it to, but it was interesting nonetheless. But anyways, Nick Nightingale in, considering I'm forgetting the actor's name, in this film, Gross Anatomy, he's reading The Cell. So he's studying, and he's got this big book on his desk, and it's The Cell. And it was interesting because until I watched The Cell this time, because I haven't seen it since the early 90s, I didn't realize that the serial killer in it is Private Pyle from Full Metal Jacket.
Absolutely right. I remember actually seeing, I don't know how or why, I saw that movie in the theaters, and it was what's his name? Yeah,
but you know what I'm saying. We could look all this up and get their names right. So
it seems, I don't know why I can't think of the guy's name. That's pretty sad, but D'Onofrio, Vincent D'Onofrio. It was there. I just had to think for a second. So what made you gasp? The fact that you saw Private Pyle?
The thing that made me gasp was when I realized all at once that, okay, that's Nick Nightingale. Because I'm like, oh, the actor's so familiar. And I was thinking about him in Walking and Talking. And I was thinking about him in some vague recollection of him and something else. And I'm like, oh, he's Nick Nightingale. Oh, what made you drop out of med school? So he dropped out of med school. He says, I got invited to leave. And he took the invitation in Gross Anatomy. Wow. So they're in med school. And he's in med school with Matthew Modine. And Matthew Modine is essentially Tom Cruise, like in the film.
Oh, Jesus. That's pretty heavy.
Yeah, he's the class clown, and he makes it. So he's the clown, and he's the success. This whole thing, it was really interesting. Also that Matthew Modine's father in the film, his last name is Cash, and I just like the idea of the Joker as Heath Ledger burning the giant pyramid of cash and saying everything burns, and the fact that Nick Nightingale in this is like basically burning up his whole everything. He's like, fuck it. And he was taking amphetamines, and they find out, and that's why he gets invited to leave. So he could fight it, but he doesn't fight it. He's just like, fuck it. But anyways, just that whole thing with like I'm visualizing Tom Cruise saying, "What made you drop out?" You know, like kind of like looking down on him for it. You know, here he is playing the piano at the craziest secret society party you could imagine, you know. So anyway, I don't
Have
know.
you considered that in the Batman comics, Robin ends up taking, like, you know, when he gets older, he ends up taking on the name Nightwing?
Oh,
So, like, Nightingale, Nightwing?
I got you. I like it. That's interesting. And I love Kotza pointing out that the robin gets its red breast. This is an Irish thing, I guess. That the robin, the bird, gets its red breast from plucking out the thorns from Christ's brow. And then, if we know that the thorn is literally meant to be the yud on the top of the Zion, which is equated, so they have this whole thing in Kabbalah with Tiferet, literally is crowned with a false crown, and that's the Ot. And so when you look at, well, where do we see a false crown but the crown of thorns? And the symbolism of the crown is actually literally the crown on the letters in the Torah. So there's certain letters that appear with the crown. So it's also taken as a shin with three Zions. So Zion is a sword, right? From the you'd say like the lovers is equated with Zion, and then Shin is judgment, and so it's, excuse me, appropriate in that respect from a European occultist standpoint. But just on a basic Kabbalistic level, you have that it's literally he's being crucified on the tree. So, and you know, the nails are all Vav, you know, and Vav is a Zion is literally a Vav with a Yud on top. So, but anyways, the robin plucking out the Yuds from atop Tiferet is just a really, I don't know, it's a very direct symbolic thing, especially when you consider that Batman is literally a vampire, and the fang brings us to judgment again, because judgment being shin, it's literally a fang. That's the meaning of that letter as a pictograph. So it's interesting. Anyways, that's thank you.
There were five writers for Gross Anatomy. How do you write a movie with five dudes?
I know, it seems like it's like a kind of a sword fight there.
Jesus.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. The fact that they're taking apart a dead person, and the first scene in the main hall where they're dissecting the bodies, Matthew Modine picks up the guy's head and is like talking through him, like as a joke. And then the teacher walks up. And it's just like, what are you doing? You know, and like there's a direct, like very direct correspondence in this film with Full Metal Jacket with the drill sergeant. Whereas the teacher in this film is like a drill sergeant, but she ends up dying actually, just like this drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket. I just like, there's something weird going on there. I'm just saying.
Have you seen Todd Field's movies that he directed?
Who's Todd Fields?
He's Nick Nightingale.
Oh, that's his name. Okay, thank you. What has he directed?
Have you seen Little Children? With, what's her name? Kate Winslet.
Oh,
And he did another one before that called In the Bedroom.
it's
Pretty
not.
excellent movies.
In the bedroom. Did you say little children? You don't mean heavenly creatures?
I meant, Little Children.
Okay, what is little children?
And what's the Little Children line in Book of the Law?
Whoa, yeah, what is it?
Come take your
Little.
fill of. Anyways, Field apparently was like best buds with Kubrick near the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were. He studied under Kubrick, and I think he's credited in some of. maybe I'm wrong on that, but I just remember reading that they had a pretty strong relationship, and Kubrick was real supportive of his work as a director.
Huh. I wonder if Jennifer Connelly walks to the end of a pier in this movie. Yeah, I'm trying. Do I need to pull out Book of Law and feel like, okay, there it is. Let me see. Yeah, what is the actual line? Little children. I recall that, but I'm not. Do not hurt the little children or something. I don't know. It might take a second.
So, David, you were able to watch the Blade Runner sync up with Boards of Canada?
Yeah, and I loved it. I watched it three times. The first time I watched it was actually I happened to be up at 4 a.m. I saw your post there, and I recommending that I watch it at 4:30, I believe. And so I got it together. I watched the director's cut, or the final cut of Blade Runner, with Boards of Canada, Tomorrow's Harvest. And first of all, just perfect, like as far as like the whole feel of the album. Interesting symbolism as Tomorrow's Harvest in the first place. Had me thinking of the code name for Empire Strikes Back as Blue Harvest, which, you know, the secret, what was used by George Lucas to keep that film on the DL, right?
Or, okay.
Yeah, was that not, maybe it was Return of the Jedi, but yeah, one of those was called Blue Harvest. And anyway, whatever, I thought it was great. I after watching it, so I have a specific method that I adopt when I look at, when I'm experimenting with synchronicity with films and albums, where I pick a timing and I watch it all the way through, unless it's something major is like that needs to be there. But I keep my eye out repeatedly for instances where I'm like, well, if this was this much different, that would have been more on point. And I keep a tally in my head of how many times that occurs, the specifics of where it occurs, and whether or not the shift is reoccurring, like in the same way. So if I see that there's 10 to 20 seconds or something, you know, where I'm like, well, if this was forward or backward this amount of time, then this and this would have added up. And when it reaches the point where there's like 10, 15, 20 things that all are doing the same thing like that, where I'm like, that was about, you know, whatever it is, 5-10 seconds different in the same direction, then when I watch it again, I go back and I do my best to align it so it will be that, and then I see if they fall at the exact same point. So like that's what happened with Metropolis, where I'm watching it over and over and over again with the Fame Monster, and then I'm like, there was like literally like fucking 40 things that I'm like, well, if these all went like in a row, that would be incredible. And then what do you know, when I hit the right timing, you know, once the Babel story starts, then that starts to occur. And I'm just like, holy shit. And so I did that with the Blade Runner. That was my observation, was that it for me and my, what I was looking at, it seemed to want to be about 4 seconds after the Daat matrix tree drops out. And so when the screen turns to black after it does that digital tree, which is interesting too, if you think about the fact that the album's called Tomorrow's Harvest and you have this Daat matrix tree at the beginning, you know, it's like and it's like the harvest is like a technological harvest, you know. I loved it. But then I watched it that way and things felt to me that they aligned more. And then I realized that, wait a minute, the whole fucking soundtrack is ambient. And there's no beats in this movie. I'm like, why not put the volume up? And so I put the volume up, and it seemed to be better to not overpower it, anywhere near overpowering it with the volume. Just keep it at a reasonable level so you can still hear what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's kind of drowned out, you just, you know, relax. And then in between the songs, you can definitely hear everything that they're saying. And that was fucking cool. That was like they made the soundtrack. They made a score for the album, and it was a different thing because there's very little, if any, lyrical content. There's a few little samples where they're counting with an electronic voice, but even like none of that interfered in the slightest with watching it with the sound on. I really liked it that way.
Yeah, you know, I'll definitely have to check that out with the audio from the movie mixed in. It's intriguing to think of it as a score in that manner. But for me, you know, as these mixtures of music and movie, I always see a new dimension to the film that I've always missed. And usually I'm able to do that when I turn off the sound of the movie, because then I can sort of not be distracted by the dialogue. And where the dialogue is pulling the narrative, I can just sort of let the whole symbolic representation going on, you know, kind of write my own script into it. And there's some really key parts of that movie that I never really focused on before that really changed the entire scope of that film for me and makes me believe that, I don't know, I'm curious to have your take on a few of these things. First of all, there's a picture, there's two different scenes where Deckard is rifling through photographs, and the first time he's rifling through them, on the borders of the photographs, they're just black borders, but then there's a second time where he's rifling through them, and there's red numbering on the edges. Did you notice that?
Mm-mm, I didn't notice that.
And then there's another instance where he's looking at a picture, and it's of a like a stereotypical house, and there's a dark-haired woman on the stairs holding a girl in her lap.
The android, he didn't know she was an android.
Right. But if just taken from a different, like, removed from the narrative of the story, for me, that picture is the essence of Philip K. Dick's whole mystery, right? You have, you know, well, for me, you know, the dark-haired girl, he wrote a book called The Dark-Haired Girl about his obsession with that. And the woman sort of looks like Tessa Dick in that photograph. And the child on her lap can represent both Christopher as his wife and child that he's separated from, but it can also represent his younger twin sister who died shortly after birth. And it had never occurred to me that they had put Philip K. Dick into Blade Runner. I had never seen him represented, his actual person, in the movie before. And once I kind of hooked my brain on that component, that whole movie just completely opened up for me. And I was just wondering if you had caught onto that stream of thought at all.
No, I like it though. I mean, I'm not a K. Dick buff. I mean, I've seen the films more than I've read the books. I mean, I read a large portion of Scanner Darkly and really liked that, but it was basically that it's not that far removed from the film. And Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, obviously, but I didn't know that he had wrote a book called the Dark Haired Girl. I'm not as familiar, so, but that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, because I never noticed that they work in the imagery of, you know, how Valis, the early prototype of Valis, he referred to it as zebra.
Mm-hmm. You told me that. I didn't know that.
Well, they definitely work in the zebra element into the film in a couple of key instances, as well as the light of Valis. And I guess I could have done a more in-depth description of it right now, but my brain's a little fried. I've been up late watching movies with this Boards of Canada album. But essentially the thing that really just overpowered me with the viewing with the different soundtrack was, you know, there was always that question, is Deckard a replicant or is he not? And the thing is that during the movie of Blade Runner, there are times where Harrison Ford is Deckard the replicant, there are times where he is Deckard a human being, and then there are times when he is Philip K. Dick. But they don't make it explicit as to when you're seeing who.
I mean, I saw it as, I mean, my vision's totally colored by this because I'm immersed in the study of it, but I'm seeing everything as clathodic. So I've immediately, when I see dot matrix tree at the beginning, I'm like, false tree, like technology tree, like, but not just technology, but just like the tree's backside, right? And so the replicants I see as like substitute reality. And that they're like, you know, his job is to literally kill these replicants that are running amok, right? I mean, that's his whole deal, is he's a hitman for that. And so they call it retirement, but I like just kind of, I couldn't help but connect it to Metropolis with the idea of Maria getting a replicant, and they're like, and then the fact that, like, what does the replicant do but rebel against the empirical structure and get the people literally to destroy themselves in the process, right? Or destroy their houses or whatever. And so I you know, and then I'm connecting things back to Star Wars in that way with the droids, you know, it's like, I don't, and then the fact that it's the same principle, and obviously C-3PO is modeled after Maria's replicant in Metropolis, but then just the fact that, like, this girl that he's literally falls in love with, and they have this whole connection, she's not from the actual Tree of Life, she's a replicant of something that was actually created, so she's made. I don't know, it like brings up all these aspects. It links directly into this whole web of synchronicity that I've been kind of obsessing on. Oh, I don't know if I had a tangent ready, Bill.
So I'm curious if you see the replicants as, you know, sort of these representatives of the false tree, do you see them in any way feeding off the real tree? Do you see a real tree in Blade Runner?
I think from the get-go, it's the whole point that you're watching a film, and that film itself is that, like, in the first place. And that's what seems to be emphasized everywhere. Like, that's like Kubrick's relationship to film is such that from the get-go, there's a reality behind it, which is like the beginning of 2001, where you see that projector behind the planet that's supposed to be the sun, right? And you're looking at this at the light, but you're looking at, like, it's projecting its representation of itself. So it's like, you know, it reminds me of Elton John's line in Gray Seal, which is supposed to be Great Seal, where he says, on the big screen, they showed us the sun, but it's never bright in life as the real one. That the screen itself, being the monolith, is a representation of something in the first place. Here, you're literally taking moments of time and trying to capture them, which you can't ultimately do. You can just kind of, you know, mimic what it would be like to do that, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's a model of a model of a model. It's all we can create.
Copy of an imitation, because it's an imitation in the first place, because all our perceptions are, you know, are removed from the reality from anyway. And then you're sitting down to watch a film, and what is it doing but just reflecting a further expression of what you're already dealing with there. So I don't know. Man, that's like, oh, you need to mute. This is what we call dead air.
Okay, I'm back. I'm sorry. Bill wrote back in 1 second, then he wrote, "All right, I'm back." So I was like, "Okay, perfect." Musa was waiting to run a Vitamix, and I was like, "All right, wait." And then Bill said he was back, so I was like, "Okay, go ahead. I'll mute." Bad timing, I guess.
Whatever. Did she run it?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay, you're good. Anyway, Amy comes out and serves me blended. Like, I have a blended coffee drink, and so like every day I do this, I get this coffee drink served to me. It's awesome. So.
Yeah, it's pretty damn nice.
So I'm looking through here, and in the Book of the Law, and I mean, at the very beginning, it's like, "Come forth, O children." It's just, you know, before the children of men, and I'm not stumbling upon the little children remark, though I know that there is one. But I was, I saw something else, and I'm missing where it is now, but that I was liking about the Exorcist. I don't know. This is a fucking crazy book. And it's like him, and it's like, I don't know why. Like, you notice that every time you have like a channeled work from somebody, like even like the starseed transmissions or whatever, it's like you can always see the person if you know other stuff that they've written and what they're about. Like, in the, it's not like, I mean, this would be interesting if it was absolutely completely removed from anything he was at all familiar with, but it's all stuff that he's familiar with even at this point. And so,
yeah, I get what you're saying.
I don't want to step any OTO members' toes here, but it's like one of those things.
Yeah, it's an excellent question because, you know, even this is why I think this is why Robert Anton Wilson decided it wasn't necessarily a beam from Sirius, but this was possibly his, you know, some form of his tapping into his right brain, or tapping into the collective unconscious, even though he perceived it as a beam from Sirius, that it was something more personal. But this, you know, this is almost like why I like the Anthony Peake Daemon idea. It's like, it's a part of yourself, but a part of yourself that knows more than you could know.
Totally.
You know, it's funny because my own experience, you know, my serious experience. I still don't know what the fuck to make of that,
right.
And you know, the idea of, like, is it something external or is it something internal? Is it something that I could have known something about? And I don't know. It's an excellent question. And I, like, what I kind of come to is, it's always going to be both. Like, even if it is something external, which I'm not convinced that it is, but just to give the benefit of the doubt, if it is something external, it's still going to be filtered through the medium, for lack of a better term, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to see the person's personality in there, because there's still the lens through which we're getting to look at this otherworldly thing. So I mean, who the hell knows? But like, I'm not big into the channeled stuff. I'm not claiming. I'm saying I have a mystery on my hands, but only because of that experience, I'm slightly more open to the idea of channeled stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've felt at times the sense of that something's being that something's tapped into and something's being channeled, but the idea of like, yeah, this is the like what, I don't know, spinning around like the idea of I was, you know, and like what, because they're like, they will literally like, they'll put up that picture and they'll meditate on this drawing by Crowley. And as far as I know, I think we've gone into this on the show before, but I don't know too many representations that or before that, that like are so close to like the classic gray image. Like he's like an alien with a pear-shaped head, you know?
Oh yeah.
Meditating on that representation to understand the thing, and so like literally like looking at the form being represented, and so I'm like, since then, how many times? Like everybody's familiar with that. That is literally a worldwide, for the most part, like familiar idea. Is like this notion of an alien. It's the most classic visualization of what an alien looks like. And so I don't know, that trips me out a little bit.
It's a big joke though, right? I mean, Crowley knew about television. He saw television coming, he saw films, he knew that they were going to put whatever the film technology was, he knew that that was going to go in the homes. And it's just a couch potato. It's just a human being that's all, you know, eyes and brain, doesn't use any other part of its body. And it's called lamb because it's like the new sheep, you know? It's just a big joke. There's nothing extraterrestrial about it. It's just transforming the human servant or controlling the masses and turning them into something different. I mean, that's just how I've read it for the last few years. And, I mean, that's just where it ends with me, you know? I know a bunch of people would disagree with that, or people would say that that's just a component of it, but it seems pretty open and shut. I mean, Crowley has a sadistic sense of humor. I mean, that was the thrust of his work, was that he will punish all fools in all forms. And at the highest levels, he will continue to punish fools. And anyone below him was a fool. So the jokes that he constructed just keep getting bigger and nastier. And I think that the cult of Lamb is one of the more... I mean, I imagine if he could see the cult of Lamb or people meditating in front of that picture, he would shit his pants, you know? It would drive him crazy with laughter that would occur. You know, I'm open to being completely and utterly wrong and having someone prove me wrong, but I pretty much stand pat with that, you know? That's kind of just where it's at for me.
Yeah, he has a very... sadistic, manipulative sense of humor for sure, and I wonder, like, the what, like, okay, so what's his name? Who's the guy? Our friend Joe Alexander, is that his name? The guy who did the okay. So you know, like in his Sync Book chapter, when he's talking about when we imagine something as possible, and then that allows us to create it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that like the maneuver of how exactly that was like worked in order, like not just him, but like it was a obviously multifaceted thing, but the just that was like a feat of projection in order to like establish, like, I mean, when you like, for an archetypal representation of an extraterrestrial intelligence, the fact that on like this scale, like this amount of people literally are, when they have this idea suggested, they have the same image come to mind. And that image is like, he's a unitary being. He's like totally etheric on a certain level, like usually, like, but he's just got this enormous head, right? But he's supposed to be ultimately no particular race. That's why he's gray, right? He's no particular gender. He's not male or female. He's just this being. And so, and then also something that Kenneth Grant was pointing out was the, if you break apart the word of, I'm not going to do it justice. I actually have the book here, but I can't remember the page number. Anyways, that you have the L-A, you have L-A-M is how, you know, it's emphasized all in capitals, like how it's expressing lamb. First of all, it should be known that it's expressed that it's coming from the Tibetan. So the word lamb, it's the same root as Dalai Lama. So like why the Dalai Lama is the Dalai Lama, which is interesting then that the first cloned sheep we named Dolly.
Yeah.
So sheep, Dolly, and then, you know, and the, yeah, and I can dig it as a joke that you're, you know, do androids dream of an electric lamb? It's like what I was saying, but, you know, there's the whole, the connection of Oz to L.A. And so Oz as strength, but if you spell it out O-Z and you flip the alphabet backwards, that L and A are what align with O and Z. And so the first part of lawn, like that's like, so the fact that it's Kenneth Grant, who's the head of the OTO at that point, is emphasizing the LA literally in the ninth arch. I find, and then he goes on to speak about the egg capsule, which he must have repeated a lot because I've heard that reference. I doubt that opening that book on the internet, I just happen, of all the pages to look at, see him emphasizing Lom as an egg capsule. And so I think of like Salvador Dali's Eggman, right? The man emerging from the egg. And obviously the Star Child, and that this is like, that they're expressing that our projection of an extraterrestrial being is literally like both a window and a mirror into our own evolutionary outcome on perhaps simply a etheric level, or like what we are on a etheric level in the first place even. But that's the idea, like, yeah, he's getting a communication from an extraterrestrial intelligence, but really that intelligence is perhaps archetypal, like unitary expression of our own collective intelligence more than we're aware of. It's a trippy thought, but...
So I need to tell you this. One is that I love that you just said Eggman is a huge sink for me, because I'm actually, while you guys are talking, I'm designing the image for the Always Record cover, you know, for this episode. And even though it's still fairly early in the episode, I don't know, was playing with this thing. Bill sent us this image from the museum, and I started playing with it, and it started to look like a Russian doll. And then since we started off talking about Mother Russia, I said, okay, let's play with that idea of the Russian dolls. And I actually just out of randomly, while I Googled Russian doll, there was these Russian dolls of Batman, Joker, and Robin done up as Russian dolls. So I have this whole thing that I'm putting together, and you just said Eggman, and I'm thinking these are, you know, that's basically what the Russian dolls are. They're like eggs within eggs within eggs within eggs, right? And I should also point out that we talked about the art card from the Thoth deck. Well, in Crowley's explanation of that card, he relates it to the Orphic egg.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Okay. Wow. So the Orphic egg is literally the egg surrounded by the serpent, which is symbolic of the green line that spirals around the planet in Kabbalistic text. So
right, he's basically saying that it's the Philosopher's Stone and the Orphic Egg are the same thing. If you give me a second, I can pull it back up.
That's awesome.
Sorry, give me one second just to find egg. Okay, you asked about what the text was, right? And it's vitriol, visit the interior parts of the earth. He says, the counsel to visit the interior of the earth is a recapitulation on a higher plane of the first formula of the work, which has been the so constant theme of these essays. The important word in the injunction is the central word, rectificando. It implies the right leading of the new living substance in the path of the true will. The stone of the philosophers, the universal medicine, is to be a talisman to use in any event, a completely elastic and completely rigid of the vehicle of the true will of the alchemist. It is to fertilize and bring to manifested life the Orphic egg. And he says, earlier he says, blah, blah, blah. This card represents the hidden content of the egg described in Atu 6. It is the same formula, but in a more advanced stage.
So the Orphic egg is the same formula in a more advanced stage than the Philosopher's Stone, or vice versa? Or did I interpret that wrong?
We'd have to go back to 6. He's saying it's a more advanced stage of Atu 6. What is that, lovers? Let's see.
Strength, but I could be off in my brain.
The lovers or brothers? 6.
The brothers are actually, I found out, Romulus and Remus.
Right.
And that's crazy time, because then you gotta consider that there's a weird thing going on there.
So, which we talked about Brother Bear and the three brothers. Well, here he's saying this can be the lovers or the brothers. Okay. The symbolism of male and female is carried on still further by the weapons of the king and queen. He bears the sacred lance and she the holy grail. Their other hands are joined as consenting to the marriage. Their weapons are supported by twin children whose positions are counterchanged. For the white child not only holds the cup but carries roses, while the black child holding his father's lance carries also the club, an equivalent symbol. At the bottom of the hole is the result of the marriage in primitive and pantomorphic form. It is the winged Orphic egg. This egg represents the essence of all that life which comes under this formula of male and female. It carries on the symbolism of the serpents in which the king's robe is embroidered, and of the bees which adorn the mantle of the queen. The egg is gray, mingling white and black. Thus it signifies the cooperation of the three supernals of the tree of life. Yeah, let's see. Yeah, it goes on a little bit, but that's the basic idea. I like that the egg is gray because it's a mix of black and white, and here you have your...
I think that Lom is literally like the egg man and the extraterrestrial intelligence are literally one and the same. So man emerging from the egg is literally like, you know, stepping, basically breaking the... Okay, so literally the shell of the egg is the klipot. So stepping out of the klipot is like stepping out into day, like the Egyptian Book of the Dead, right? Stepping out into day and opening the mouth. Okay, so we've been coming across a reference to the Orphic egg in our studies that keeps getting repeated. And the serpent is literally taken as da'at, first off. So you have knowledge being passed from teacher to student, from teacher to student around the entire globe. So the green line, which is knowledge, stretches around the globe. So it started in one place, and then, but it's literally, it's also klephotic. And they say, like, this is considered, you know, blasphemous or whatever at the time. And so it wasn't allowed publication for this and a number of reasons. But it actually suggests that the Torah itself is literally the serpent skin. So like the spiral of the two pillars of the scroll are literally, you're stretching the skin of the serpent open and you're reading the Torah down the serpent's skin. it's literally expressing that the Torah itself is our perception through like this shell. So literally there's a screen between what we're actually looking at, so that we don't see things for what they are. We're literally looking at the klipot all the time, and that's influencing all of our perceptions. And because we're all in agreement, because we've all been taught it, we don't see it because we all believe it. So if it's through a consensus affirmation that we perceive our perceptions as real. And so they're unquestioned. So Klipot is literally shell. And so the shell of the Klipot is literally the Orphic egg. And the serpent that's entwining the egg is literally holding the shell in place. So it's through the, it's actually the knowledge itself that's keeping together this Klipotic reality. And so then also the, we were having difficulty. My teacher especially was obviously, because he's the one translating this and I'm reading it and we're going along, but he couldn't figure out what was happening because the way that the word Aram or naked was being used in relationship to the Klipot, he wasn't realizing that when Adam and Eve realize that they're naked, as opposed to the first naked, when they're naked and not ashamed, and then God says, who told you you were naked? That naked is literally the Klipot. And this is how it's taken Kabbalistically.
So you're like, saying when he says, who told you you were Klipot? Instead of Adam and Eve realized they were naked, it's actually saying Adam and Eve realized they were Klipot?
Saying that their skin, when they're looking at their skin from this new consciousness that's getting in, right? They're literally, their skin is literally colored. So they don't see their skin for what it is anymore. Like their skin, like, and so that when it says they put on clothes, it's literally skin. They put on skin is how it translates.
Wow, and that's really good.
And so the skin that they're putting on is literally the shells of this, the outside ones, is literally the Hetzonim is the Klipot. It's how it translates. So pretty weird, huh? And so then you have, like, you know, to get into our area here, you have a Poltergeist 2 is called The Other Side, right? You have the dark side of the rainbow. In Poltergeist 1, the father's like, which side of the rainbow are we on anyway? My understanding is that the dark side of the rainbow is looking at things from the Klipot's perspective. So instead of looking at it from our perspective, so it's not necessarily a transcendence, it's just the flip side. The dark side of the moon is like the Klipotic side, looking back at ourselves. So it's literally a mirror, but it's like a mirror mask. Kind of trippy.
Right, because we have to there is no dark side of the moon really, so we're, you know, it's all projection in a sense, right? So, and this is interesting because the Orphic egg, you know, the Greco-Roman tradition of the Orphic egg holds that serpent is actually time.
Right, same thing.
Knowledge. Right. Yeah. So, go ahead.
Knowledge is time. That's all I'm saying.
Right. So it's like the idea is though that, you know, the time encircles. Of course, it's you know, we can go to all the agricultural metaphors and things like that. But for me, this is really the idea of Grant Morrison's Disinfo speech when he says, like, yes, we exist or there are these higher beings that exist outside of time, or there are aspects of us that exist outside of time. But we have to step into this dimension because things grow in time.
Right.
So it's the idea of, like, you could have this egg and the serpent might break down that shell, but you need to break out of that shell. Otherwise, you stay in your egg forever. You know, it's like, do you want to live in this safe little womb or do you want to hatch and become your potential? And a lot of times these hardships are what are going to, by eating away at these little creatures eating away at the shell, well, that's going to help you break out of it. Does that make sense?
Right. Well, they're literally permeating the space. So, but it didn't even occur to me before. I'm over here talking about that when John Lennon says he's the Eggman, supposedly he was a huge fan of Salvador Dali. And so he's literally referencing his classic painting of the man emerging from the egg. And then also that was why the white piano with Imagine was his Salvador Dali's famous white piano thing. And that he just loved that expressionist art, but that he's Salvador Dali. And so Dali, the Dalai Lama, for the sheep is Dali. That's the clone sheep. So I don't know. That aspect had never occurred to me before. Because
we've now stepped to the place where Salvador Dali is our religious icon.
I don't know about.
I mean, meaning, you know, meaning he's showing us a new take on religion. I mean, if you've seen, he has the more famous sort of Christ on this floating cubic cross, but there's also he had made this thing which I was lucky enough to see an exhibit, a traveling dolly exhibit, where they had, it was basically 3D art. He had two images of Jesus being crucified, but they're spaced about, I don't know, 7 feet apart. And then you have to like stand at this specific spot in the room and look through this thing, and the two paintings sort of overlap in your eyes.
Dude, that's so perfect. That's ridiculous. Keep going, sorry.
Oh, no, please, I want to hear what you have to, I guess my thing would be like, so you have the dark side of the tree and the light side of the tree. When you bring them together, you see this, the full image.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this. I've been rereading Illuminatus trilogy. And the first time I read that when I was like 22 or something like that. And, you know, I tore through it and loved it and got a lot out of it. But I never read it again. You know, I pretty much went in all the directions that book points you in. And now rereading the book, you know, like 15 years later, I've been structuring it in that, you know, it's sort of like that exhibit that you're talking about. I have the Illuminatus trilogy way back there when I'm 22, and now I have the Illuminatus trilogy right here when I'm 37, and the books are separated by time, right? And each book has a different meaning for me because of my cognition level, you know, how much I understood or what things meant to me. And that the book doesn't really complete itself until you're able to have that separation. But that separation can only occur in time. So I have always thought that when rabbis say, you know, study only begins when you're 40, well, I think it speaks to this separation, that you have to have like a young person's understanding of it, and then you have to have an older perspective of it, so that you can bring three-dimensionality to the text itself, so you can actually really see it for what it is.
Right. I mean, I think their idea with that is that it's context dependent. And so, you know, they're like, if you're not completely immersed in the work, then when you go to very high places, you have nothing to fall back on. And so they want this whole thing established. But then things aren't as they used to be in terms of everything all at once. Is like, we live in, like, it's inevitable. Like, I mean, theosophy was an innovation, right? To take all these different schools and see how they connect. But I don't think what people realized back in the day was what it meant for this to be an inevitability. And so, like, Lom itself, or whatever, the gray alien I see as like the inevitable outcome of everything coming together. And so, like, he's like serious in the sense that he's the third pillar, right? So it's like you have, like what Alan said about, you have these two sides, right? You have these two pillars of the temple that are established in strength, right? But that they're reflections of each other, and one is reflecting on the other. So you have one pillar is the sun and the other is the moon, and then you have the backside of that. But that basically, so the klipot are literally represented by yud hey vav hey backwards. So hey vav hey yud, you know, in reverse. And so they're literally the mirror. And so, like, this is all too perfect in the sense that it needs to, you need to put it all together into one thing to get the three-dimensionality. It's like a Tool's album 10,000 Days that came with the special glasses. And there's all the Crowley references that are obviously, I mean, you see the cards themselves, but how everything stands out when you relax and you see it merge. Have you seen that before? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I've heard about it. I didn't know there were special glasses, though.
Yeah, it comes on the album, is these glasses. and they pop up.
Is this
up.
Like, so this is why when you play something backwards, you hear the satanic messages because you're really getting the quixotic version. But what you have to do is like John Fell Ryan and play The Shining forwards and backwards at the same time so you get the full. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Continue in that same direction is we need to play the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus backwards and forwards and play Tom Waits over it.
I'm totally down for that. Anything that involves listening to Tom Waits, I'm down with.
I'll buy a ticket.
Dr. Parnassus with Tom Waits, Alice, followed by Blood Money, followed by Closing Time, and that was awesome. Highly, highly, highly recommended. So, just for time, got anybody interested? It's when there's like there's a capital, I guess. I mean, I know it's supposed to take place in Europe, but it looks like the White House. But it's got to be some capital somewhere. I mean, it's a big building. But right when that shows up at the very beginning, which is the first cut. I mean, it's after the beginning credits. That's when I started that, and that was pretty nuts. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in there, and it's the inevitability of it because his lyrical content and his whole style combined with the way that film is shot is just, I mean, it feels like a Tom Waits movie, like the whole style of it, like the gypsy fucking thing that's going on. So anyway.
But that whole idea of the separation of a text can only be understood once you've processed it in one time space, and then you process it again with separation, and then and only then can you really see what the text itself is. Maybe this is why music is so flexible, is that an album that is released today, you can overlay it with a film from the past, and they merge because they sort of connect through that separation. So, because the thing that's weird about this Boards of Canada album that I'm obsessed with is that I watched it last night with Apocalypse Now, forgetting in the moment that Harrison Ford pops up, you know, 30 minutes into the movie,
right.
Connecting it with Blade Runner.
Right, he's living in the movie, so you got him.
And so there's that one song on the album that's an anagram for Apocalypse, so... but whatever, watching Apocalypse Now with that album, I mean, it's a perfect fit. And while I'm watching it with Apocalypse Now, I'm trying to say, okay, where in Blade Runner is this? And I can't, in the moment, even comprehend how Blade Runner and the album mix, because there's such an intense entanglement between the music and what I'm currently watching. And then at that moment, it was so late, I just had to throw it on. I put Tree of Life on. And I was convinced when I went to bed that Tree of Life plus this Tomorrow's Harvest is the perfect match for that album. And, you know, Tree of Life, you have the real tree compared to the fake tree that opens Blade Runner. So I had built this trio of films that all have some sort of connection, and then they're all connected through this album, and each experience is completely and utterly fascinating and entertaining. I don't know. It's just, it's such a completely bizarre phenomenon, but one that is seemingly far more accessible through the style of music that Boards of Canada makes, because it is ambient music and there are no lyrics. And if that's an accomplishment, it makes Pink Floyd an even more, even bigger accomplishment, because they were able to incorporate basic song structure and still make that transformation work. My head's rattled with this shit right now because I'm just standing in the middle of it. It's very hard to not convince myself now that, you know, it's just my own subjective powers at work here, because it's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah. It would be fun to play them all together with the album, and you know.
Well, you know, I've tried to play three movies at once with one album, because when me and LeClaire were doing the Pink Floyd tensor work, you know, it was with Eyes Wide Shut, The Shining, and 2001. And I tried playing the alignment with having all three movies play at once, but there's something about that that just completely shut my brain off. That it was too much information. It just went too far, and there's just no value in it. There's more disorientation. But I don't know. Maybe the right drugs and
right.
It'll
kind
all
of
work.
Focus. Yeah.
But I definitely am interested in combining, you know, Apocalypse Now with Blade Runner or Tree of Life with Blade Runner, just because this music just, I don't know, you'll have to check it out. It's pretty stunning.
Interesting that the guy who did Tree of Life, he did the Thin Red Line, right?
Yeah.
So in Kabbalah, it's literally a thin green line is the serpent that surrounds the planet, and the planet is the Orphic Egg, and so I'm just saying that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, no, like, I was thinking about that when you were mentioning the green line.
Yeah, it's like, and so you have, and then green and red. It's green, red, and white are the colors of Malkuth. And so not obviously in the European system, but there's this whole thing around that in 16th century Kabbalah. So I don't know. It's interesting. I was like, because when I first heard that, I was like, what, Christmas? Why is she's represented by the colors of Christmas?
I'm all right. Nobody but a man.